Blue moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon.
All right. Hello. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we are here until 4. It is Monday, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. That's coming up later on. We got some Carson comedy classics. You can watch the Johnny Carson Show every night on Antenna TV, and we always like to play back some comedy, either some stand-up or a sketch or an interview. Well, we got some stand-up from Franklin Ajay. From 1988. We're also going to talk about outdated words that age you, instantly age you. Some expensive mistakes as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Our guest right now is our good friend Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. You can check out rodpylebooks.com. If you have any space-related questions or comments, give us a call, 312-981-7200. Let's welcome Rod to the show. Hello, Rod.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you, sir?
I'm okay. I saw Greyhound today. That was a thrill.
Yeah, I watched it over the weekend.
Did you?
I did. I liked it very much.
It was just nonstop, and they didn't spend a lot of time on character development other than Tom Hanks, did they?
No, they didn't. They didn't. Now, it was a solid movie. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I was really impressed.
Yeah. All right. Rod, tell everybody about yourself.
Well, I'm old enough to have been born about the same time the space age was and grew up during those heady years. It's funny. Somebody asked me a day about what's the difference between a writer my age, I'm 63, and somebody who might be in their 30s and 40s or writing about space and related fields. And I thought about it for a minute, and I thought if you're talking about the space program anyway and the space race, there's a lot of younger people writing about it, and they're very excited, and they're good writers. They're very good writers in a lot of cases. But, you know, you do get a different perspective, as I'm sure you remember, having known some of that stuff that happened before the space station and before the later part of the shuttle program. So it was really a blessing to have been around to have seen that and to have experienced that. So I grew up being totally enamored of that. So other people were following sports, baseball and football and later basketball. I was an astronaut groupie, although I wasn't following him around, but I was following what they did.
Right.
And then I got into documentary filmmaking and different kinds of television production. And finally, in the mid-2000s, started writing space books. And I've written 17, and I'm working on number 18 now. And I also edit, as you usually point out, Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society, which is great fun.
Ad Astra is a terrific magazine. Tell me a little bit more about it.
So it's been around since the 80s in one form or another, and it's won a bunch of awards and so forth. And back in those days, a lot of pro-space organizations had print magazines, but gradually, one by one, they've kind of winked out of existence. So I think at this point, it's just us and maybe one or two other groups. And it's about 64 pages. The nice thing about our magazine is because we're a nonprofit, we don't have much advertising in there, just 3 or 4 pages. So when you open it up, instead of having to flip past endless advertising and having all those little blowing cards fall out to ask you to subscribe, if you're getting it, you're already a member of the society. So it's all just content. So we try to have some historical content in every issue. We try to look forward to the big picture of space development and settling human beings out there. And just look at some of the various issues. You know, people will ask sometimes, well, what does space settlement mean? And that's one of the key tenets of the NSS. And yeah, it means putting people out in space colonies, either in some kind of orbit around Earth or elsewhere, and putting them on Mars and the Moon. But it also means all the things you have to do to make that work, like figuring out, for example, how to deal with dust on the Moon. There's no weather on the Moon, and that dust is very fine-grained and very sharp-edged, and it just wreaks havoc with spacesuits and instrumentation and everything else you have to have to do this successfully. So there's stories on things like that, too, that you might not think about normally.
All right. And Ad Astra is the magazine, and it's a terrific magazine, Rod.
Thanks. And it's available online now, so you can get it on Amazon and whatever Apple's calling their their book magazine repository this month.
Okay.
I think it's Apple periodicals, Apple magazines now.
Is that what it is?
The iTunes. I think so. Yeah. They changed it again. Yeah.
Confusing. You got to keep it up. Got to keep up with this. So, but you know, before we had you on, Rod, we were talking UFOs.
Yeah.
And the Senate Intelligence Committee confirms that the U.S. Navy has a UFO task force.
Yeah, it costs money to run, apparently.
Uh-huh. Well, tell me a little bit about that, if you know anything.
Just that Marco Rubio is sort of leading the charge because he's the head of the Intelligence Committee. And I think they want to know where the money's going. And partly, you know, the first conclusion that's easy to draw is, oh, he's a UFO junkie and he wants to know all about Roswell. And, of course, there are a lot of people who want to know about Roswell. Hell, I want to know about Roswell. I've never been there.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look into a little deeper, and it's not just analysts, but also people inside the Beltway saying, well, what they think this is really about as much as anything is they want to know if there can be a unified structure within the military to look at unidentified aerial phenomena, which includes UFOs. And all UFO means is unidentified flying object. So I think at the core of this, probably more than wanting to know if we've been visited by aliens, is wanting to know what the threats are on our own planet. So, for instance, you and I talked before about the tic-tac UFO reports and so forth back from the early 2000s with the Navy. And, you know, there's a fairly broad consensus about this, that it's a very good chance that these are some kind of drones from a foreign power. Now, one of the pushbacks on that has been, and I got some email after the last time I was on your show about this, that the observations of them show them moving impossibly fast and changing course impossibly quickly and altitudes impossibly quickly in ways that normal air-breathing craft couldn't do. But that's assuming that you take the observations verbatim. And, you know, pilots are as good as they are. The human eye is notoriously not good at tracking distance and altitude and speeds. So even looking at the radar imagery, which is pretty low resolution, or I should say FLIR, because it was the specific kind, you know, it's hard to tell exactly what these things are doing. So applying traditional models to it hasn't been very successful, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're extraterrestrial in origin. So getting back to the original question, I think there's a concern in the military bandwidth, if you will, about these different branches of the military, of the armed forces, sharing data better about what they're seeing and
right.
seeing if it represents a domestic threat or not.
Right. Okay. Rod, hang on, okay?
Yes, sir.
I want to talk more about this, too. Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. If you have any space-related questions or space concerns or any of that kind of stuff, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Nick DiGilio, and we will return. Hello, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. Coming up, we've got some classic comedy from the Johnny Carson show, this morning featuring Franklin Ajay. Outdated words that instantly age you. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. 312-981-7200. That's our number if you have a space question of some kind. Give us a call because our friend Rod Pyle is with us. Rod, welcome.
Hey there.
So what was the date again, Tom, that dates back to like the first recorded UFO? It was like 16, what was it, 60, was it like 16 something?
That was 1639, March 1st, 1639, John Winthrop, the then governor of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Now, doesn't that seem like a long, long time ago? I mean, I was surprised when I heard that the first UFO reported was in the 1600s.
That's really interesting, actually. And, of course, that was before there was any such thing as aircraft. So
right.
Unless you buy into the whole swamp gas discussion, Could have been a lot of things, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, the swamp gas thing? Let's explain that.
As I understand it, it's the idea that marshes, you know, there's a lot of organic decay in marshes of plants and so forth, and they start forming methane, and that somehow that becomes, that ignites, and you see these balls of flame that can last for a little while, depending on, you know, wind conditions and all that. I'd never seen anything like that. The weirdest thing I ever saw was a high tension line that had I guess it was arcing or shorting out. And there was this big ball of blue electricity going down the wire and then actually blew off the wire. It kind of looked like it would hovered. I guess that's a plasma at that point.
Mm.
And that was pretty fascinating, but that's as close as I've gotten. And, you know, I've been reading about UFOs since I was about 6 or 8. And, you know, I'm like anybody else. I want to see one, but I just haven't seen a good sighting yet. I've seen a lot of things. I mean, I've spent, I don't know how many hundreds of nights out under the stars. About the most amazing thing, I've seen two things that were jaw-dropping. One was a huge green, it's called a bolide. It's just a very large meteor that went from one horizon to the other and exploded about halfway overhead. It didn't hear anything because it was way up high.
Yeah.
And the other thing was there was a meteor shower in, I think, April called the Leonids that's famous for every, I think, 33 years being extraordinarily heavy. And just by sheer luck, as a kid in Pasadena, California, I was out looking at the stars that night, and I knew there was supposed to be a meteor shower. And when they say shower, you know, it's maybe one every minute or two. It's usually not a big deal. Well, this just opened up like God was pouring a salt shaker in the sky.
Wow.
And it was terrifying, but really spectacular, and I feel very, very blessed to have seen it.
Wow, that's amazing. So,
but you can imagine in 1650,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
If you saw that, what would you think? I mean, you'd have to ascribe something supernatural to it because we didn't know what they were.
Yeah. When we were talking about that earlier, I was like, man, there's nothing else in the sky, and you know,
right,
at that point.
Well, and that's why, you know, when you talk about, I've written about Mars a lot. You know, we start off by talking about, you know, how the ancient world looked at Mars and why they thought it was so different and all that. And one thing is it's red, so it was the color of blood and fire, and so they ascribed all kinds of death and mischief and mayhem to it. But also, it made these weird motions of the sky, not that you'd see them in any given night, but if you tracked it from night to night, the point at which, because of the way the orbits intersect visually intersect with Earth, so it goes retrograde, it starts going backwards for a
right.
while, and then goes back the other direction. And of course, back then you didn't have sodium lamps every 10 feet lighting up your neighborhood. So when you looked up at the sky, you saw everything, which is kind of what I think you're saying. And it's real different. I mean, I don't know that many people anymore that have seen a truly dark night sky where you see that. I was actually out with one small group out in the desert, and even in California desert, by the time you get away from one city, you're getting near another one. So it's not dark, dark, dark even there. You have to go out in the ocean if you really want true darkness. And the kids got scared because they saw this white stripe in the sky. They said, what's that? And I said, that's the Milky Way. That's the edge of our galaxy. And they're like, wow, I didn't know you could see that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've told you this before, Rod, when I was on a trip to Ireland. My ex and I were in the kind of, we were walking back from a pub in the kind of middle of nowhere. And it's the first time I ever looked up and saw, because there was no lights. There was nothing. We were walking down a road. And it was the first time I actually looked up and saw what the nighttime sky really looks like.
Yeah.
You know, because I've lived in the city my entire life. And here we are in the middle of nowhere walking down this dirt road back to our hotel. And I just couldn't believe it. I just looked up and I was like, oh my God. So this is what it really looks like.
Yeah, it's really something. And sadly, it's going away decade by decade. And there's actually a group called the Dark Sky Association or something that's trying to campaign to have, you know, fewer lights or at least shielded lights in certain areas so that there will be more darkness so that people can actually go do amateur astronomy and see the beauty in the night sky. But then right as that's actually starting to pick up speed, then you got Elon Musk trying to put 10, 15, 20, 30,000 satellites up. So everywhere you look, there's going to be a little white moving dot. So it'll be really pretty, but it's going to make it hard to look at stars.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's too bad. I hope people, you know, would be able to at least, you know, a couple of times, just see what the sky actually looks like, not what you think it looks like
yeah.
living in the city, because it's really different. It's really different.
It is, and that's why, I mean, it's a shame because a lot of planetariums are sort of going under because they're not a popular thing to do anymore because it's a pretty slow attention span kind of activity. But if you've never been to one, a good planetarium is an almost perfect replication of the night sky, and it's pretty breathtaking when it's done right.
Well, we have a great planetarium here.
Yeah, you do.
Chicago. The Adler is just amazing. I can't tell you the number of times I've been there when I was a kid. I haven't been there in a long time, but I can't tell you the number of times I've been there when I was a kid. And it's just beautiful. It really is.
It is. And you see them. I'm still in touch with the people up at Griffith Observatory in L.A. where I used to work, and they have a 600-seat planetarium up there. And they, when I was working there in the 80s, we had an old Zeiss projector that was just this masterpiece of German clockwork. Everything was mechanical. And it was sensational. You know, we could go in there after hours and set it wherever we wanted, whatever night sky, whatever year. Now, of course, everything's being modernized, so a lot of these are going electronic. And they still look great, but it's much more entertainment-oriented than it used to be. And, you know, that's progress, and you've got to be okay with that. But there is that moment where you first would dim the lights, or the planetarium operator would dim the lights, and it would go down from the blue horizon lights to pure dark. And if they're good at it, they kind of do it in increments. And each time they go a little further, you get a little gasp from the audience.
Yeah.
And finally they dump them entirely, and they go,
yep.
I say, yeah, that's what it's supposed to look like, you guys.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really is. They used to have right around, I don't know if they still do this at the Adler, but at Christmas they would have a special about the star,
right?
And it was beautiful. We used to go every year. It wasn't really Christmas time until we went to the Adler.
Yeah, and there's usually something about what was the star of Bethlehem.
Yeah,
you know, was it a star? Was that a comet? Were they looking at Venus? Was it a UFO? What was it? And I don't think anybody's ever answered the question to complete satisfaction, but it makes for a good show every single year.
Oh yeah, no, it was one of my favorite things to do at Christmas time. I haven't gone in a long, long time.
Well, now you got to go.
Yeah, I do. As soon as everything reopens, yeah.
Well, there is that. Yeah,
yeah.
That little problem.
Yeah. Now you mentioned the Griffith Observatory. That's the one that's featured in Rebel Without a Cause, right?
It is. It's also featured in, what's the name of that show? Rocky Jones Space Ranger. So we all remember it from Rebel Without a Cause, of course.
Wait a minute.
I'll get there. And there's a statue of you know, James Dean down front. But there was this awful show made in the 50s. I shouldn't say awful. It was about as good as anything else science fiction of that era, called Rocky Jones Space Ranger. In the opening of the show, he drives up in an old Jaguar XK120 with the top down. And doesn't open the door. He leaps over the door like James Bond would 10 years later and runs up the observatory stairs because that was Space Command headquarters or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't even recall the name of that show.
Yeah, I know. It's about as obscure as Radar Men from the Moon. Did you ever see that?
No.
Oh. So that was made in the late 30s, early 40s, I think. It was a Republic Studios serial. So,
oh,
you know,
okay.
They were half hour or whatever.
Yeah.
And they ran in the theaters on Saturday matinees. And, you know, it was Buck Rogers-type spaceships flying around, making a sound like an airplane with 19 propellers and smoke and sparks coming out the back and dropping instantly to the stage floor.
All right.
So it wasn't very convincing. And then you can see the wires and all that. And the thing that got me was, you know, it's supposed to be invading moon men, right? There's a few variants on it, but that was the general theme, the guys to the moon. But everybody, except for the grand poobah who, you know, had a funny costume and weird things over his eyes, for some reason, all the henchmen were just guys in suits with fedoras and snub-nosed 38s. And I remember as a kid watching this thinking, where are the ray guns? This even isn't even as good as Lost in Space, which I caught the other night, by the way. I hadn't watched broadcast TV in a long time, but where I am now, I'm actually wired up so I can get over-the-air TV. And by gosh, they're playing Lost in Space at 2 in the morning where it belongs.
Yeah.
It was every bit as awful as I remembered.
Yeah, I grew up watching that show, so I have a soft spot for it. And for Dr. Smith.
What was wrong with Dr. Smith? I mean, there are a whole bunch, you know, as an adult, you look at him and you think, okay, I've got some questions about this guy.
Yeah.
But proclivities. But yeah, he was a little over the top. But apparently, he was a very serious actor, and even in recent years when he was interviewed about it, he'd talk about it in a very thespian sort of way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just look at him and think, yeah, that didn't look like you were taking all that seriously.
Well, but you know, the whole show it's interesting how that character changed, because at the beginning, he was supposed to be just like this straight-up villain, and then he just said, oh, no, not me, take the boy, and then it just became...
That's good.
It became really ridiculous. Now, wait a minute. Now, Tom, you found a little more info on...
Well, yeah, Rod mentioned this about the henchmen just being guys in fedoras with snub nose.
And this is on the show.
Rocky Jones
Radar
Space
Ranger. Moon.
Okay.
Well, this is a little bit about stuff. Rocky Jones Space Ranger. This is an actual paragraph here. Although many strange worlds were visited, the alien characters usually spoke American English and always appeared as normal humans, albeit in bizarre costumes and environments. The script writers did not appear to know the difference between planets, moons, stars, and constellations, so that the specific locations Rocky and his sidekicks visited are generally unknown to astronomers.
That sounds about right. Well, and then, you know, and that was early on. Then you get to Lost in Space when we did know better, because the space age was in full flower then. But you still got, everybody's got two legs and two arms and two nostrils and two eyes. They may look like a giant styrofoam carrot, but they're still bipedal. And it got to the point, I think I told you before, I took a directing class from a guy who had directed a number of episodes of Lost in Space years ago. Really nice guy. And after class, I got to talking to him once, and I said, I have to ask you a question. He said, shoot. And I said, Lost in Space. And he kind of smirked and looked around like he hoped nobody was overhearing us. And I said, you're a great director. Why? And he said, it's very simple, my boy. Alimony. And I said, okay. And I said, tell me the truth, though. It really looked like you were dumpster diving to get those costumes together, and that the scripts were kind of written around whatever you could find. And he said, that was it. Irwin Allen was this really tight-fisted producer from that era. Did some good shows, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Lost in Space, Time Tunnel, you know. But they got towards the later seasons of Lost in Space, the budgets were so small, they were squeezing every dime out of it they could. They would literally, apparently, go around the studio. She would have been cast off. So that's why one week you'd see aliens that looked pretty good. Then the next week, I think the low point I remember was aliens that had sheer nylon stockings pulled over their faces and white sequin top hats and capes, because some vampire movie had thrown away a bunch of stuff and they found it and said, okay, write it in.
It's fantastic. Oh, all right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. More Space Talk with Rod coming up here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. During the break, I was just scrolling around on the internet. Kelly Preston passed away. She's only 57. She had a few years battle of breast cancer, and she passed away. So condolences to the whole Travolta family. I love Kelly Preston. I just thought she was great, and it's really sad to hear that she passed away. She's only 57 years old. So sorry to bring down the mood, but let's get back to our talk about space. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're talking with Rod Pyle. He's our good buddy, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. You can check out rodpylebooks.com for more information. And hello, Rod.
Hi there.
Hey. So let's talk about a day in space.
Yeah, thank you. This is something that was put together over the last couple of months. So the National Space Society does a yearly conference every year called the International Space Development Conference, and we invite big thinkers from yesterday, today, and tomorrow to come talk about just about everything. There's, I think, 30 tracks with multiple speakers on each, so there's tons of stuff. It lasts about 4 days. Wow. It's usually about 1,000, 1,500 people, and we move around to various cities. But, of course, this year we had to cancel like everybody else. And we're a volunteer organization, so there's a lot of what should we do about it. So finally, a small group has got together and said, okay, let's do something virtual. But we didn't want to do a Zoom call for all the reasons that we've discussed before, like Zoom bombing and so forth.
Yeah.
So we decided to give it the full court press as much as we could. So I sent out production kits to a bunch of people that were our keynote speakers, about six new ones, and then we had some stuff that we had already recorded before COVID hit. So a couple lights, microphones, so forth, just to really try to bring it up a notch. So on July 16th at 8 o'clock Pacific and 11 o'clock Eastern time, we'll be starting a seven-hour day. And we've got speakers ranging from, we've got Buzz Aldrin doing an exclusive interview with our president, Jeff Notkin, who used to be on the show Meteorite Men. He was the host there, interviewing Buzz. And that was really fun. So I've edited all this stuff, so I know it way better than I want to, because I've spent, you know, a couple of days with each one of them. But,
right.
We've got another astronaut panel with Al Worden, Fred Hayes of Apollo 13, Walt Cunningham from Apollo 7, and Jerry Griffin, who was a flight director at NASA during the Apollo years. And that was recorded about a year ago when Al Worden was still alive. So they have a lot of great stories to tell. We've got an astrophysicist, Sarah Seeger, talking about exoplanet discoveries. We've got Alan Stern, who ran the New Horizons probe out to Pluto and beyond, talking about that mission. We've got a gentleman who runs another conference that I participate in called CI Live out in Iowa, who's also one of the officers of the NSS, named Anthony Poston, who's talking about the secrets of achieving anything great. A space doctor talking about space medicine named Shauna Pandya. And one of my favorites, Steve Jurvetson, who most people probably won't know the name, but he's a billionaire investor who put tons of money in new space. He invested in SpaceX, and they were about to go under in 2008. Just a brilliant guy. I think I told you about it before. He got through Stanford Engineering in 2.5 years by basically gaming the admissions computer system.
Jeez.
He's that smart. And sitting with him for an hour in a room interviewing him, it's like all the air gets sucked out and the atmosphere becomes kind of electric. And he's just so excited about everything he's telling you. And he's got these incredible visions about the future of what he thinks is going to happen in the next 20 years. So that's really exciting. And then finally, myself and Rob Manning, who's the chief engineer at JPL and was the chief engineer on all the Mars rover missions, I have kind of a SmackDown session where I tell him, you know, when I was growing up, Mars was this really cool place with aliens and oceans, and, you know, we thought it was kind of like another Earth, and then you guys at JPL came along and ruined everything. And then he builds the argument, because I'm a romantic at heart, right? He builds the argument, well, yes, but truth is better than fiction and supposition, and now that we've found the history of water there, we're building back your verdant Mars and blah, blah, blah. So it's great fun. And we had a big man hug at the end that agreed that we needed both sides of the story. That'll be going on that day. And we will be on space.com,
okay,
on their website and their YouTube channel. And we'll also be on the NSS YouTube channel and on NSS Facebook Live. And on Facebook Live, we'll be, as many of the speakers as we can get in, we'll be answering questions in the text box off to the side. So if you want it to be interactive, go on Facebook Live.
Wow, there you go. And that's a day in space on July 16th.
Yes, sir.
Oh, that sounds great. That sounds really, really great.
And I expect a really pithy question from you about the Mothman or something, okay?
Yeah, I'll make sure to disrupt the whole thing with a Mothman sighting. Here's Big Ed on WGN. Go ahead, Ed.
Hi, Nick. Am I coming in?
Yes.
Okay, hey, Rob, I just want to ask you a question.
Sure.
What happened to Skylab and Soyuz? Why didn't they work out?
Well, Soyuz is the Russian spacecraft, so I think you're thinking about Mir, which was their big space station before the International Space Station. So I'll take them one at a time. So Skylab was the first American space station, launched in 1973, had some problems, first crew went up and fixed it. And it was up there till 79, I think. The idea was it was supposed to stay up long enough, and the shuttle was supposed to happen soon enough to go up and tow it to a higher orbit and keep it around for a few more years. Because we could have gotten another 10 years out of Skylab. It was a very capable space station and big. It was still, to this day, it was the largest single volume compressed space in ever put up in orbit.
Yeah.
I think it was 33 by 80 feet or something of that nature. So it was big. Problem was the shuttle got delayed and there was a lot of solar activity happening in the late 70s, much more activity happening from the sun than normal for that part of its cycle, the solar cycle of activity. And it caused the Earth's atmosphere to actually inflate, move out a little bit, which caused just enough drag, the Skylab came down sooner than expected.
Yeah.
Now, at that point, they didn't have any maneuvering control over it, so it was just a question of when it was going to come and where it was going to go. So
I remember, Rod, vividly people freaking out about where Skylab was going to fall. I mean, it was a big deal. People were like, oh, my God, where's it going to fall? Oh, my God.
Because it was a big machine.
Yeah.
It was a very big machine. So that was that one. MIR controlled the orbit, as I recall. And that was just, it had lived out its useful life, and they had had a couple of fires on board, and the machinery was getting very old, so it was just time to deorbit it and bring it down.
Yeah. All right, Ed. Thanks for the call, buddy.
Thanks, Ed.
All right. Take care. So Skylab. Jeez. We have a local radio personality here named Steve Dahl.
Yeah.
And when Skylab was the big thing, he did a parody song to Shattered by the Rolling Stones, and he called it Skylab, and it was all about freaking out about where Skylab was going to land. And it ended up ended up landing in Australia, correct?
Parts of it did, yeah. And I mean, you probably remember that people were selling hats with bullseye on the top of them, all that kind of stuff.
No.
You know, because you got to take these things tongue in cheek as possible. You can't control them. And then a couple of years ago, that first Chinese space station, Tiangong-1. Same thing. I was much smaller. It wasn't much bigger than a spacecraft, but they lost contact with that and couldn't bring it down in a guided fashion, so it re-entered over the ocean, thank God.
Yeah.
And broke up into a few pieces. But, yeah, there's some responsibility, and actually legally now, the legal framework says if you launched it, it's your problem, so you've got to figure out what to do with it, and that applies to anything from microsat up to a space station. So we're trying to be more careful about these things.
Yeah, boy, but it was such a, so crazy. It was like the summer of 79, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Oh, man, it was nuts. It was nuts. It was like it was the top of the news story every hour.
Every night. It was like COVID is now, yeah.
Yeah, it was just so crazy. And everybody was like, where's it going to fall? Is it going to fall on our, you know, can it fall on our house? You know.
Well, think of the insurance claims.
Yeah. Jeez. No, that was weird. Yeah, Skylab. Brings back a lot of memories right there.
Right.
Yeah. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle's with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. Lots more space stories to talk about. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 with your space comments or space questions. Rod's here to answer. 312-981-7200 on WGN. Hello, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about outdated words that instantly age you, some expensive mistakes, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. 312-981-7200 is... the number. Rod Pyle is with us, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And Rod is our space expert, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. Hello, Rod.
Hello.
All right. We have another caller here. This is Hef on WGN. Go ahead, Hef.
Yes, Rod. I was wondering if any of the astronauts or cosmonauts who were in the space station had joined the 200-mile high club. And was it all official, or was it just fun in space?
That's a good question. It's been asked a lot, and there is no official recorded act as of such.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't mean it hasn't happened, because it is a co-ed facility.
Right.
But, you know, even though the space station is fairly large, the crew quarters are small. And you're separated in most cases by cloth or kind of a flimsy separator. So noise carries pretty far. So you'd have to find a real dark, remote corner and be quick. And when you think about the physics of it, You know, things bounce away from each other in space, so without getting too graphic here, you can imagine without some bungee cords, it might be kind of a challenge. That said, one of the early places to line up for a ticket when Virgin Galactic first announced that they were going to be doing suborbital rides that would give you 6 or 7 minutes of weightlessness was Vivid Video in Los Angeles, my hometown, the premier purveyor of porn, and they wanted to do some space sex, but as far as I know, they were not sold tickets, and it never happened.
This is ridiculous. Ridiculous. All right, Hef, thanks for the call.
It'll happen someday.
Thanks for the call, Hef. 312-981-7200. I never even thought of that. That never even occurred to me.
Nick, you got to think more.
Yeah, I guess I do.
The 200-mile high club.
But it brings up another interesting question, which is if you can carry that off in zero-G, and this is something that's being studied fairly heavily, can you then gestate a baby and have a healthy child in no gravity or low gravity? We just don't know because there's no way to simulate it on Earth.
Yeah.
So that's something they're going to have to figure out, probably with lab mice and other mammals, you know, before people start doing that kind of thing. But if we're ever going to go out there and stay there, that's going to have to be a part of it because people got to reproduce. And it's a big concern. So it's an interesting question when you come right down to it.
It is, actually. I mean, it didn't even occur to me. But, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, that's got to happen if you're going to spend a significant amount of time up there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, a few extra arms and legs could be very handy to get things done quicker. But, you know, you want to know what you're getting to in advance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting question. I didn't know that was going to come up.
Yeah,
is going to come up this morning. So, Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor in chief at Ad Astra Magazine. Check out rodpylebooks.com. Hey, Rod, when you were doing special effects on movies, what kind of technology did you have back then?
It was all analog. So, the only computers we had a computerized editing system, and we had a thing called the Harry. It was the name of very expensive effects machine, which you could do digital painting with. So that's what we used on Deep Space Nine to paint in phaser hits and force fields and all that.
Yeah.
But as far as the actual ships go, you built miniatures. I used to call them models, and they'd yell at me because they're not models, they're miniatures. And you'd mount them on a big metal stick, and you'd run the camera past them to make them look like they were flying past you. And then you had to do that, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 times. One pass for the lights on the spaceship, and one pass for the marker lights, and one pass for the lighting on the hull and all that. And then one of us would go into the post-production bay and layer all that stuff together to give you the final effect, which is why the effect shots on older Star Trek were so short, because they're really expensive, and that's why you spend a lot of time cutting to the captain bouncing around in his seat looking like he's in the middle of a fight, because combat scenes cost a lot to make in those days.
Mm. Wow.
That was fun.
Yeah, I bet.
It was really fun.
Yeah, I bet it was. Well, here's an interesting call. Here's Warren on WGN. Warren, go ahead.
Hi there. Boy, you brought back some memories for me. I grew up in Hollywood, and our house was in the Hollywood Hills. Brad, you'll know where I'm talking. We were in Beechwood Canyon directly across from the observatory, so we saw that out of our kitchen or dining window every day. But what I called about was I dated Rocky Jones' Space Ranger's daughter.
Oh, no kidding!
When I was in high school, we went to Hollywood High School in the 60s, and his name was Stephen Crane. He was a great guy. And we went out for a while, and I'd bring her back, and then we'd go in, and I'd talk with her parents and her and everything. But he told a story about one day he was having a phone installed in his house back, you know, the old landline days.
Yeah.
And the technician, the phone man, came in into the bedroom, and he, you know, kind of pushed the bedroom door closed a little bit to do his work. And he looked up, and he said, "Now, what's that hanging from your bedroom door?" And Stephen Crane said, "Oh, well, that's my space suit." He had brought home, for some reason, one of his pieces of wardrobe. And he was real dead serious with this telephone technician. And he said that guy could not get out of his house quick enough.
That is so funny. Now, did he really have a Jaguar XK120? Or was that just
I don't know. I don't know what kind of car they drove. They had a nice house, but that was probably, you know, for the movies,
yeah.
driving up to the,
yeah.
to the Griffith Park wow. Observatory. One other thing, in that series, the spaceships, rocket ships, took off vertically, and they came back and landed vertically. Like,
yeah, sounds familiar,
stages,
doesn't it?
If you remember
yeah.
that. Mm. And they came down, and I thought Elon Musk, they should name the space patrol thing that we've got. They ought to name the soldiers the Space Rangers.
Yeah, that's great.
That was a great series, though, boy, because I was about, I don't know, 10. That was 52 to 54. So I was yeah. 9, 10, 11 when that was on. But dating his daughter was, I mean, it was just, something kind of natural if somebody was in this the business out there.
Yeah.
But he had some stories, and that was the one that just stayed with me. I can just see this poor telephone guy.
Yeah, that's hilarious. That is hilarious. Warren, that is great. Thank you so much for the call.
Man,
oh, sure.
What are the
Thanks
odds.
For that show. Bye now.
Bye.
Thank you.
God,
oh, my Lord. I grew up, I don't know, 15 miles from Hollywood, and I never dated anybody in show business, especially not an on-camera person. Maybe Warren's just particularly good-looking. That's
yeah.
probably it.
Yeah. God, that's
well,
a great story.
Great story.
That was
Isn't
a great something? Story. Yeah, that's great. You didn't think we'd be talking about this TV show then.
I love all those old shows.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, we were talking about Lost in Space. Did you see the reboot that they did on Netflix?
Yeah, I saw about half of the first season, and I thought, okay, I get it. This is clever. This is modern. They're doing all the right things, but it just didn't grab me. What did you think?
I felt the same way. I felt the same way. I thought it was interesting that they cast Parker Posey as Dr. Smith.
Well, and having her as this megalomaniac, you know, that wants to do in everybody, so it kind of rounded out what you were talking about with the pilot of the original show. In the first couple episodes, where Dr. Smith was a pretty convincing bad guy. I mean, he was evil, and it was fun to watch.
Yeah.
And then he got silly. Parker Posey didn't get silly, but, it felt a little heavy-footed to me.
I agree. I totally agree. And then there was the movie back in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
And, wait a minute, you like the movie, Tom?
I used to love watching that, because remember, I was just a kid. Came out
You're 19... still just a kid.
I mean, yeah.
Gary Oldman was Dr. Smith,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah?
William Hurt was Professor Robinson.
Right. Is Mimi Rogers in it?
She is, yeah.
Yeah.
It's Heather Graham's in it. Jared Harris, of all people.
God, I totally forgot about that.
Matt LeBlanc.
Oh, that's right, Matt LeBlanc.
That's Matt LeBlanc. There's a piece of casting for you.
Beautiful
casting.
Totally forgot that Matt
beautiful
LeBlanc was
casting.
In that.
Okay, Tom, how many times did you watch it?
Oh, God. I think we had the VHS tape. So it was on a rotation of me as a kid. It was either The Lion King, Godzilla 1998,
yeah.
Lost in Space 1998, and, probably Twister.
Wait a minute. The Roland Emmerich Godzilla?
Yeah, it rules, man.
It's a terrible movie.
Is that the one with all the little baby Godzillas?
Yeah, in Madison Square Garden.
Oh, it's a terrible
and got,
movie.
Wake me up when the popcorn's gone, man.
Oh,
you got Hank Azaria as Animal.
Oh, yeah.
The videographer.
What's his name, Ferris Bueller in it?
Yeah.
Matthew Broderick.
Matthew Broderick is in it, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Who's the female lead?
Oh, my God. She's kind of a no-name.
I remember hating it. That's the only thing.
Oh, everybody hates it.
I remember hating that movie.
Maria, I think it's Maria Patillo. Yeah.
Okay.
But Jean Reno.
Oh, my God.
As the leader of a bunch of French Foreign Legion mercenaries. Harry Shearer's in it.
God.
It's great stuff.
Oh, Rod, is he nuts or what?
I had a friend who was living in Japan probably 25 years ago, and while he was there, they were filming, of course, another Godzilla movie, and the rubber costume was stolen from the set.
Oh,
which,
no.
I mean, nothing gets stolen in Japan. If you leave a camera sitting behind somewhere, you know, you go to a shrine and you leave and you forget your camera. This actually happened to me back in the 80s. I came back an hour later, and there were people staying there guarding it until I came back. I mean, it's that kind of country, you know? So this became national news.
I bet.
The holy costume had been stolen, and they said, please return it, reward posted, no questions asked, and all that. It was like the Lindbergh baby, you know? So it was this costume. I thought, they take their Godzilla seriously.
They do.
Nick, did you like the one, maybe it was 8 or 10 years ago, where they do the high altitude? There's been a Godzilla film made since
2014,
yeah. Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah. Did you like that one?
I did. I like everything except for the Roland Emmerich. I'm a big Godzilla guy. So
yeah.
Rod, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. We got more space stories to talk about. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 with any space-related question or concept here. Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. Check out rodpylebooks.com. And again, 312-981-7200 for your space-related questions. All right, it's time for the news.
Tall, could have used a few pounds. Tight pants, points, hollering out. She was a black-haired beauty with big
hello
dark eyes.
And points all Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here until 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock, we head over to Bradley Place on the TV side of WGN. Get some news and information from them. And then at 5 o'clock, it's the one and only Bob Surratt with your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking about outdated words that instantly age you, some expensive mistakes. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we've got Classic Carson. You can watch the Johnny Carson show every night on Antenna TV. And we like to play a little comedy from the Johnny Carson show, whether it be a sketch or some stand-up or an interview. Well, we've got some classic stand-up from Franklin Ajai from 1988. A really terrific comedian, Franklin Ajai. Legendary guy. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Rod Pyle is our guest. He's an author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. RodPyleBooks.com is the website. Hello, Rod.
Hello.
All right. We have another caller here. There's William on WGN. Go ahead, William.
Yes, I'd like to find out, why do they have running lights on the starship?
That's a good question. I think that started with the original Trek. That's the first time I remember seeing them anyway. And if you look at the scale of it, those running lights would have been the size of an RV or larger. I mean, they're huge. I saw the original model from the first series in the Smithsonian about a year ago, and it's beautiful. It's a beautifully made model, but you're right. You look at it, you think, okay, there's a way out of scale, and why are they there anyway? I think it was just to go with the nautical theme and to make it look like other things from aviation at that time. And if you recall, you know, if like Nick and I are old enough to remember when that thing was on the, when that show was on the air the first time, nobody had really made that kind of a starship before. Everything prior to that looked like rockets, and we didn't see anything more revolutionary than that until 2001, A Space Odyssey in 1968. So I think it was kind of this bridge mentality, if you will, of, okay, let's not take people too far out of reality. Let's keep this kind of nautical in nature. But, yeah, it was just a creative decision. In fact, I think I've told you this before, Nick, on Battlestar Galactica, when they're getting ready to do the reboot on that, we were working on the pre-visualization stuff. My partner came back from a meeting with the producers, very dejected looking one day, and I said, what? And he said, well, they're changing the design of the Galactica again. I said, okay, what are we supposed to do this time? He said, they want it to look like it was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, which I actually thought was kind of interesting, but that got kicked to the curb pretty quickly.
Oh, wow. I always thought the classic Starship Enterprise was just one of the coolest looking ships ever.
I did too, although I have to say, and I'm thinking biased because I worked with the 1701A miniature, but I loved that one. It was a little 59 Cadillac for a lot of people's taste, but I thought they really got it right with that one.
Yeah. All right. William, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Okay, let's talk about this story here. House budget bill denies major increases for NASA to fund an ambitious moon program. What's going on here?
Yeah, we're kind of waiting for this. So the Trump administration, as you know, wants a landing on the moon by 2024, and NASA has said, great, we're all for it. We're going to need some money to do this right. So the administration was trying to stump for, I think, about $25 million, billion with a B, for this year. And to be fair, NASA's budget up until a couple of years ago was like 17, 18 billion. So they've been getting some pretty healthy increases, which makes people in my line of work very happy to see that. But they came back and said, no, we're going to give you less than that. And the problem is the cut is almost entirely on the human exploration side, and the bulk of it is for the lunar landers. So what that means is they were hoping to scale up by 2023 to almost $30 billion. And if you do the conversions, that's about the same in 2020 dollars as what they're spending on Apollo in the 60s. So it kind of makes sense. But with that cut, I think, and just to back up a step, NASA has already let contracts to three companies, Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company from Amazon, SpaceX, and a company called Dynetics, to start designing human landers for the moon, human-rated landers for the moon. So the first step's already been taken, but as so often happens, we're kind of feeling a change in the wind here, and depending on who wins the election coming up, this may or may not be good news for the program. So whatever you think of Trump, you know, he has been pro-space for whatever his reasons are, and so this is kind of a blow to the system here, because it probably means it's going to be pushed back. I don't think they'll cancel Artemis outright, which is the landing program, but it'll push it back at least a few years, because you need money to do this. The advantage we have now, of course, is with Blue Origin and SpaceX in particular. They're both very rightly famous for putting their own money into the development of these things. So these are cooperative ventures as opposed to just being work for hire like it was in the old days with the traditional aerospace contractors. But it's still expensive to design and operate and fly. And so this is going to be a major problem.
Mm. Is there any silver lining to this?
Forced efficiency, perhaps. They'll have to figure out. You know, one thing, and this is just really off the cuff here, because I don't see any rationale for it on the side of Blue and Blue Origin and SpaceX. But you know, there's a possibility that somebody like Musk might say, I don't want to wait anymore. I was willing to do this on my own if I have to. I wanted to do it with NASA money, but I think I'll just keep pushing ahead. And he's been kind of bifurcated already, because he's flying cargo for years and now crew up to the space station on his smaller rockets. But as you know, he's still designing Starship with the other half of the company, more than half. And they're working double, triple shifts, and they're working really hard to get that thing to fly. So if he's successful with the Starship, which is his larger than Saturn V two-stage rocket that has a huge cargo capability, if he develops that on his own and the government can get a deal, then maybe they can press it into service and move away from the SLS and the Orion capsule, because that is also a big expense, because those things have been dragging their feet for a decade now.
Mm, okay. All right. Well, does it seem doable to get to the moon by 2024?
Honestly, it would be really tough. I mean, we don't even have spacesuits designed yet that can do that. We don't have the Apollo suits around anymore, and they would obviously update that design. They have been updating that design. But in terms of a real EVA-rated suit, something you can go out and do operations on the lunar surface for days at a time with, which is what we want to do now, because we don't want to dash and come home. We want to stay there. That's years off and many hundreds of millions of dollars away. So that's just one example. I mean, long-term life support, being able to land a heavy structure on the lunar surface that you can live in for weeks or months or years at a time. And on top of all this, we're trying to go to the South Pole, because that's where we're pretty sure the water ice is. So it takes more fuel and more work to get people down to the poles than it does the equator. That was kind of the easy, low-hanging fruit. So
right.
It's going to be tough.
Okay.
In either scenario.
Okay. All right, Rod, hang on. Yeah, Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. And if you have a space-related question, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200.
You're looking kind of lonely, girl. Would you like someone new to talk to?
Oh, yeah, all right. I'm feeling kind of lonely, too, if you don't mind. Can I sit down here beside
you? Right. Nick DiGilio here on 720W. Is that Dr. John?
Dr. Hook.
Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show.
If it were Dr. John, it probably sounded a little like this.
Yeah. I knew it was a doctor.
Not Dr. Feelgood.
Nope. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio. We're here until 4. Coming up at 2:30, we got some comedy from the classic Johnny Carson show. You can watch the Johnny Carson show every night on Antenna TV. We got some great stand-up from 1988 with Franklin Ajay. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday. Right now we're talking with Rod Pyle, who is author, journalist, and editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, rodpylebooks.com, if you want to check out his books. And if you have any questions about space or anything like that, 312-981-7200. Hello, Rod.
Hello.
All right. So let's talk about this. Is this Roscosmo?
Roscosmos.
Roscosmos.
Yeah. Is, over there, I guess they say Roscosmos.
Ah. They're going to send two tourists to the space station in 2023, and one of them will spacewalk?
Yeah. Now, talk about an experience that could put your stomach up in your throat. So the Russians have actually been the only ones so far to fly tourists into space, and it's something they've done well. They're working with an American company called Space Adventures. So they flew tourists up to Mir. And the last tourist up to the ISS was 2009, I think. But, you know, they've got this quandary now, which is we're using SpaceX and we'll soon hopefully be using Boeing to ferry American astronauts up to the space station with our own spacecraft, which means we're no longer paying just over $80 million per seat to fly American astronauts in the Soyuz. So when you have a budget that is only about $2 billion, which is what the Russians have, I keep thinking, you know, I go back in book land in my head and I keep wanting to say Soviet Union. It's not Soviet Union, it's the Russians. When you've got a budget of $2 billion, $80 to $100 million at a crack adds up. So that's a big chunk of revenue they're losing every year. So it makes sense for them to crank up the tourist flights. And on the U.S. side, NASA finally said, okay, we're going to do that too. And they're going to start doing that in fairly short order here. The question is, so you've got these people up there, they're taking up room, they're breathing air, they're eating food. How much do you train them, and what do you have to do while they're up there? Do you actually assign them tasks, or are they joyriding? And that's something that has been a little different in the case of each person that's gone up so far. So that's just to go up and visit the interior. Now you're going out on a spacewalk, which is inherently many, many times more risky than just staying in the space station,
because
you're just transferring from a docked spacecraft. So now you're going into a full EVA suit. You're going to go outside. What is not clear to me yet is whether they're going to have any duties to perform. But these guys train, you know, before they go up to do a mission where they're going to do an EVA. You've seen the EVAs. They go on for hours and hours, and they replace components and so forth. They train for months or years before then in the neutral buoyancy tank in Houston, which is that huge multi-million gallon tank they've got in these weighted spacesuits. So they've got at least some simulation of gravity and some feel for what they're going to be approaching. As you go into wrench, in space, you turn a wrench, and the wrench stays in one place, and you float in a circle, you know?
Yeah,
so there's a lot to know. And so we don't know yet who's going to train them or how extensive it's going to be. So it's exciting, but it would scare me to death.
Yeah, I can imagine. I don't know. I mean, that just seems... I mean, how do you train for a spacewalk?
Well, that's what I was talking about, the neutral buoyancy tank. So
yeah.
It's a big, huge water pool. And it's about as close to simulation as you can get. The only problem is, of course, water has resistance, and a vacuum of space doesn't. But at least you've got a sense of weightlessness and a generally convincing simulation of it. And that was what, in the early days, back in the Gemini era, back in 65, 66, when they finally got spacewalking right, because they wanted to figure out, can we do work outside the spacecraft? And it wasn't until Gemini 12, the last flight, which Buzz Aldrin flew on, that they were able to actually get all the assignments done, because he, largely on his own, as I understand it, just decided, okay, I've got to do this underwater training, because clearly what we're doing isn't working. And that was what made all the difference in the world. So it's very effective, but it's also really expensive.
Yeah, well, you know, for the tourists, what do they have to pay?
I don't know what they're paying the Russians. It was in the
$20 to $30 million range before. I know if you're going up on the NASA ride, it's going to be $52 million to the flight provider, which would most likely be SpaceX for the next number of years. And then I think it's $35,000 or $40,000 a day while you're on the station, which is not very expensive if you're a really rich person.
Right.
It's just the getting there and getting back is pretty pricey.
Jeez. All right. Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
Keep an eye on what's going on over there in Russia.
You want to go?
No.
Okay. You want to think about that for a minute? Nope. Done.
Oh, man. All right. We have to talk about this. There's a perfume that smells like outer space.
Ode to space.
Ode
Did
to
I
space.
Say that right?
I think
yeah.
so.
So this chemist who's done some other fragrances has started a Kickstarter campaign, which has already raised $200,000. You saw the article. I was kind of stunned when I saw that.
Yeah.
Trying to reproduce what space might smell like. Now, of course, this raises the immediate question of how do you smell in a vacuum? And what does a vacuum smell like? Well, there's nothing there except very tiny trace amounts of atmosphere. So it probably smells like the upper atmosphere, if anything. But regardless, he is moving on undeterred. So apparently the scents that he is working with are gunpowder smell, burnt steak, raspberries, and gum. With a little bit of sweat and oil. So the idea behind the gunpowder is that's what moon dust smells like. I'm not quite sure. I guess maybe they're simulating space if you're on the moon. Yeah, because the astronauts often said that's what moon dust smelled like. As far as the other stuff, these are various accounts from astronauts that have been on the space station. But it's Chris Hadfield, who's the famous Canadian astronaut that played his guitar and sang while he was up at the space station. He made a very good point, which is what occurred to me when I was reading the story, which is, what you're smelling is when you come back of the airlock, when you open up your helmet, right? So inside your helmet, you're smelling yourself, which after 8 hours of hard work is probably kind of fragrant. And then you open the visor, and what you're smelling in the airlock, which has been exposed to a vacuum, is whatever's outgassing from the airlock. So it could be, an odor from the rubber seals. It could be an odor from various machine components that have been oiled and so forth. So it makes sense that it would smell more like machines than it would like something else. But that's the list of things that he's combining to do it. And it's novel. One other person said that space smelled sulfurous to her.
Okay.
Which kind of puts sort of a dark spin on the whole thing. But yeah.
All right. Now, is this going to be available in stores? Is that the plan?
That's the plan.
Wow.
Because why not?
Yeah, I guess.
It would make more sense to me to what I'd like to try is making a men's cologne out of Venus.
Out of Venus.
Yeah, because Venus is really an incredibly toxic place with acid rain and a really nasty atmosphere full of methane and other awful things that you can't breathe at 900 degrees Fahrenheit. So you could make this stuff with various perfume scents and then an acid base, so it burned your skin when you put it on, so it felt like you were standing at 900 degrees. Somehow I don't think I'm going to do well on Kickstarter, but it's just a thought.
Yeah, I don't think that's I don't know if that's going to work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good idea.
It's just spitballing.
I have lots of bad ideas.
Oh, boy. Okay, so Ode to Space.
Ode to Space.
Ode to Space. The perfume that smells like...
behind the ear will do you.
That's yeah. it. The Kickstarter campaign has over 4,600 backers.
Yeah.
And almost $200,000.
It's astonishing. And the interesting thing about Kickstarter, if you ever considered doing a campaign on there, is depending on the kind of project you're doing, you have to do a lot of fulfillment of tchotchkes and gifts and gimmies and all the stuff
right.
that you give everybody for the money,
right.
for the money they're putting in. And quite often when you run the dollars out plus Kickstarter's overhead and everything, you're not left with that much. But I think in this case, he's going to do pretty well.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
I mean, frankly, I'd rather just burn a steak and rub a little fat behind each temple and, you're 80% of the way there. But
yeah.
I guess this is doing it the right way.
Do we have a time frame on when this is going to be released?
Didn't see it.
No. Okay.
Are you anxious?
No.
Okay.
Ode to Space.
Just curious, yeah.
The perfume that smells like outer space.
Yeah.
All right.
I want a perfume that smells like cosmonauts.
You could call it Swarthy. Just single. The single names work best, you know, just Swarthy.
Swarthy is that's actually one of my favorite names, one of my favorite words.
Isn't it a great word?
Oh, Swarthy. It's just the best. It's the best.
Have you ever been called Swarthy?
I've never been called Swarthy. I'm pretty much the opposite of Swarthy. I can tell you.
I was called Stately once, and it was not a compliment, I realized.
Stately?
Yeah.
Well, who called you Stately?
Somebody who I think was trying in a not very concealed way to make fun of my slightly wide aspect.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you think of houses when you think Stately, and I thought, oh, it looked like a, hey, wait a minute.
All right. Well, Ode to Space. You're looking forward to that perfume. All right. There's a new Mother's Day gift coming out right there.
Hey, do we have a second? Talk about something that was on the list.
Let's take a quick break, okay, Rod?
Okay,
and we'll jump right back to what you want to talk about. Rod Pyle is with us. RodPyleBooks.com, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. If you have any space-related questions or comments, it's 312-981-7200. And now we'll jump back into the conversation after this. Right. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4. We are going to be talking about outdated words that instantly age you, some expensive mistakes. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke later on. And we've got some Carson comedy classic with Franklin Ajay stand-up from 1988. Right now, we are chatting with our good friend Rod Pyle, who is an author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. You can check out rodpylebooks.com. If you have any space-related questions, give us a call, 312-981-7200. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, Rod, you wanted to say something, right?
Yeah, I want to talk about the comet Neowise for a second, because it's been in the news.
Okay.
So this is something that the average person can go look for. I've tried twice, but I'm down in San Diego right now where there's a fair amount of city light, so I have not been successful yet. But the best nights, they're saying, are July 11th, 12th, and 13th, so it's coming right up. And if you go out about an hour before sunrise, which is perfect for you, and look to the northeast, and if you can get on your smartphone one of those constellation apps that, you know, superpose the constellations over the direction you're looking for the constellation Auriga, which is Auriga, and there will be this what looks like a fairly bright star. But if it's very dark or you have a pair of binoculars, you'll be able to see this long tail extended behind it, and it's this comet called Comet Neowise, which is swinging around the sun right now, or has swung around the sun, I should say. And that's the material, because comets are basically ice with some rock, but mostly ice. That, because you've seen the movies, right? So you know this already. They can be blown up with dynamite. And this is the ice being vaporized and streaming off in this long tail. And then between the 14th and 19th, apparently, it will be visible just after sunset.
Oh, okay.
And this is the best one since about 1998, and we probably won't see another one like this for years in terms of just something you can go out and you don't have to know exactly where to look and just go, oh, look, there's a comet right there.
Oh,
so pretty
cool.
Exciting. Yeah.
All right, very cool. Get somebody get out there and take a look in the sky. How often do cool things happen in the sky that we should see?
Well, it kind of depends on what you classify as cool. So every year we have a dozen or more small meteor showers, which are the Earth in the Earth's orbit, is going past an old trail of a defunct comet, and they're basically kind of spread out gravel banks, and as that stuff enters the atmosphere, you see some meteors. Most of them are pretty small, but in the summer and the winter, almost 6 months apart, they're the Perseids and the Orionids, and the name just means what constellation they appear to come from. And those are generally two of the best ones. You can see a meteor every minute or so. It helps to go somewhere dark, but you can even do it from within the city. Most of them are pretty small. They just look like a little, about that fast, little streak of white light. But occasionally you'll get a bigger rock coming in here the size of a marble or a golf ball, and it'll actually burn for a while and make a pretty spectacular show. And sometimes they explode because they got little gas pockets in them or irregularities, and they actually blow up while they're coming in, so you can get a pretty good view of it. So that's every month or two, there will be some kind of meteor shower happening. Other than that, it kind of depends on what turns you on. You know, we get lunar eclipses a couple times a year. We got solar eclipses, good ones anyway, maybe a couple times a decade, depending on how far you're willing to travel. We got one coming up in, I think it's 2024, which is going to be going through your neck of the woods. And if you've never seen a total solar eclipse, that is one of those stand still and be transformed moments. I've only seen one, but it was unbelievable because you're looking at this ever diminishing sun, well, through solar glasses, hopefully, so you don't burn out your retinas.
Right.
And then the next thing you know, it hits totality and everything gets very quiet. The temperature drops. The animals start freaking out around you because they think, wait, how did it become nighttime so soon?
Right, right, right.
You know, the crickets start chirping and all that. But the whole sky kind of takes on this almost kind of silvery aspect, and it's really quite an one of the most amazing natural things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've witnessed that. It's pretty amazing.
And the other thing I'd say is, if you got a pair of binoculars, a small telescope, I personally never get tired of looking at the moon because it's so close and large enough that you really feel like you're exploring the surface from here. You know, with Mars, even with a big telescope, you get kind of a fuzzy red ball. But with the moon, you can really see especially at the right phase, you can see the shadows being cast by mountains and crater rims and so forth, and really just get an incredible sort of, if you will, walking tour of the moon in your mind. Even with just a pair of binoculars is all it takes.
You know, I've never really asked you this. I don't think I've ever asked you this before, Rod. Do you recommend certain telescopes?
You know, I haven't kept up with it in the last few years. They're a lot cheaper than they were when you and I were young, when you were dropping, you know, $1,200 for a decent 8-inch telescope, because there's so much stuff coming in from China, and the lenses are much easier to make now and so forth. Celestron is always a good bet. They've been around for about 40, 50 years, and they make very good telescopes. But, you know, anything with a decent mount, what you don't want is something that just has an up-down side-to-side, or what we call alpha azimuth mount. You want an equatorial mount, because with the traditional mounts, if it doesn't have a computerized drive on it, you have to keep nudging it up and sideways and up and sideways to track things because of the rotation of the Earth. And depending on what latitude you're at, it has to be set for that at an angle. So what they call an equatorial mount, which you can look up on Amazon, telescope equatorial mount, will automatically track things. And then if it's got a computer drive on it, which you can get for just a few $100s nowadays, the whole package, telescope with a computerized drive, you just punch in the code of what you want to see. And if you've got it aligned to north properly, it goes zip, zip, and there you are looking at the Andromeda Galaxy. So they really have come a long way.
Wow. Wow. So, that's, I mean, I guess I didn't even realize that they were computerized now.
Yeah. And I first saw that, and I, you know, being kind of an old school astronomer from when I was younger, I'm like, that's cheating. And then I thought, wait a minute, that's really nice, because you used to have a book called The Ephemeris, and you looked it up. You'd look up what you wanted to see. You'd look up the date and your latitude, and try and figure out, you know, the right coordinates. And you'd look at these little tiny things called setting circles with tiny, impossible-to-read numbers with a red flashlight. So they didn't ruin your night vision. Then you had to set it and look through the spotter scope and hope you were kind of in the right quadrant and all that. Nowadays, you just put in the digits and boom, you're there. And, you know, on a cool summer evening, nothing better.
Wow. Okay. But we've come a long way, huh?
Buy a telescope.
Tom, you ever have a telescope?
Yeah, but I never really knew how to use it. I had this dream of being a scientist when I was young after watching the movie Flubber.
After what? Flubber?
Yeah.
With Robin
the
Williams?
Flubber, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, the one with Robin Williams. I was really into that, and I was like, I really want to be
cool.
A scientist. So I got one of those fun little kits that's like it was a microscope, but it had a screen on it, so it was easier for like a kid to see.
Yeah,
because I was quite young and I had a telescope, but I don't think I ever really set it up right, so I couldn't really see anything out of it. But I had it there, and I would try every once in a while to look at something. And
it was just there for show,
kind of. Yeah,
yeah.
It's what you have when you finally are rich enough to get that beach house. You always have to have a telescope on the window.
Exactly. Yeah,
you know, Nick. You know what Tom never did have, though. I'll bet. That cool chemistry set we had as kids, where they would give you powdered magnesium and other stuff that would burn really well.
Yep, we've talked about this before, Rod, about how It's amazing. Mine, yeah. It's amazing that people around our age are alive.
That still have their fingers. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Because honestly, it's just it's a and you know, sometimes Tom, you just you're like, that's not real. You're making this up. No.
Well, I think maybe it was our pal Trucker Rich maybe mentioned, or someone mentioned, that at one point they had stuff that may have been even radioactive, like low levels of radiation or things
radium.
Radium.
Yeah.
So it's like, why would you ever put that in something for children? They might just eat it.
Oh, listen.
Kids just eat stuff. Right?
Mercury.
Mercury. I mean, it's amazing the kind of stuff that we had when we were kids. It's insane.
I was cleaning my garage a few months ago, and I found the set inside is gone, but I found the folding metal box from my first Gilbert chemistry set. And it has this young, very white, reddish-looking kid with a red sweater vest and a bow tie on paint, you know, printed on the front of it, with a couple of test tubes, looking very serious. And I thought, I don't remember ever looking like that. I was just trying to make stuff blow up and burn.
Yeah,
those were always the first chemicals you used up. You didn't care about all that other stuff. But yep. Give me the things that burn and make a big
exactly.
Flame.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah, everybody our age, you know, around our age or something. You're a little older than I am. Rod, but
don't rub it in.
We had the chemistry set. We had the chemistry set and a wood burning kit.
Yes, that was another one. Yeah. There were a lot of toys that were really dangerous back then that either had heating elements or projectiles or that air gun that you could blow up people's eardrums with.
Right.
I mean, it is. You're right. It's amazing that we survived with all our fingers and both eyes.
Yeah, the wood burning kit to me is it's astonishing. It's basically a soldering iron.
Yeah,
like you're giving a 7-year old a solder. I had a wood burning kit when I was a kid.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just, you didn't even think about it. You didn't think twice about it back in the late '60s, early '70s. It's like, yep, just give the kid a soldering iron.
He's got to learn somehow.
Yeah,
yeah. So you slowly run it along this panel of wood to make a picture, and it's like, why don't you just give the kid a felt tip pen? It looks the same.
Yeah.
But he's not going to sit down on the carpet and then have a 3-alarm fire in 15 minutes, which is what almost happened to me.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I set it down, and I got distracted because I was a pretty heavily ADD kid and wandered off. And the next thing I came back, and there's this big hole melted in our brand new plastic carpeting from the '60s. And I thought, oh, that's going to smart when my parents see it.
That's not good. That's
so I started cutting fibers from other parts of the carpet and sort of trying to glue them into the spot so it wouldn't show.
No.
It wasn't successful.
I was going to say, how'd that work out for you, Rod?
It didn't work out well. It was like the time we broke the window and tried to glue it back together. It just didn't work. I had a very understanding older sister that was my partner in crime for these things.
Well, at least you had a partner in crime. I'm an only child, so...
All the crimes were done by you and you
exactly.
alone. No accomplices.
Nobody else got blamed. Nobody else could be blamed. It's like, hey, you're the only kid here.
That's true. There's nobody to point at.
There's nobody.
No. Nope.
You can't. That's it, man. You get blamed for everything.
So does that mean you're like uber accountable as an adult?
No.
Okay. Just checking. I figured I had that one nail.
Tom's losing it in there. You're laughing a little too hard,
yeah,
pal.
Sorry, no. Pardon.
He's enjoying this more than he really
should. You're laughing a little too hard. Okay, Rod, hang on, because we got to talk about some dino-killing, ice-spewing, earth-destroying asteroids.
Okay.
All right, hold on, Rod. Rod Pyle is with us. If you want to jump in, if you have a question or a comment concerning space, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Always great to have Rod Pyle on. Check out rodpylebooks.com. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about outdated words that instantly age you. Classic Carson clip from Franklin Ajay and some stand-up there. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And our phone lines are open at 312-981-7200. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. Check out rodpylebooks.com. Hello, Rod.
Yes, sir.
All right. Let's talk about some of these insane asteroids. many of which I can't pronounce.
You have, well, I know which one you're talking about in particular. I've been struggling with that one for years. So, yes, we'll call this segment Nick's Asteroid Lust.
Yeah.
So where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with the Tunguska impact asteroid.
Yeah. So Tunguska event, as they call it, was 1908, and this was in Siberia. And it's an area of about 830 square miles that was just wiped out.
Jeez.
Millions of trees were destroyed. It wasn't a crater, but it looked like a blast radius. And there were not many people there then. So as far as we know, there were no deaths or maybe just a handful of what I suppose they would have called peasants in the day. But it was this enormous either impact or explosion. So it's been theorized as everything from a comet to a meteor to a miniature black hole. The most convincing, I mean, the explanations, depending on who you ask, are all over the map, but one of the more convincing ones is that it might have been either an airburst, you know, a meteor that came in and then exploded overhead and took out this big chunk of territory, or even a glancing blow by something that entered the atmosphere and then bounced off and left, but left this big shockwave behind. But one theory says the meteor could have been as big as 330 feet in diameter that exploded overhead, which would have resulted in an explosion of somewhere between 3 and 30 megatons, which is big.
Wow. Yeah, that's big. Oh. All right. What about Behold the Dino Killer?
Chicxulub, there's something along those lines. Chixlub.
Right.
Because if you're going to name it something weird, right?
Right.
So that was an asteroid, we think, somewhere between 70 and 50 miles wide. That's a pretty big range.
Jeez.
It hit in the Yucatan Peninsula about 66 million years ago, which is, as you point out, what ended the reign of the dinosaurs. Whichever size it was probably big enough to cause a global tsunami and, of course, horrible atmospheric disturbance, which would have poisoned a lot of things just by changing the atmospheric balance. And then, of course, all the darkness, which would destroy crops and things that they're not crops, sorry, but the plants and fauna, that the flora that these things need to eat. So you have this kind of nuclear winter. And the crater is just under 100 miles in diameter. And you can see it from orbit. It's really clear. It's this big ring that's mostly underwater now. And, and that's what let the tree shrews climb down out of the branches and become us. Because if something hadn't taken the dinosaurs out, we'd probably, you know, they'd be our masters.
Wow.
We'd be their pets or something.
Okay. What about the 243 Ida?
So this is imaged by the Galileo Jupiter probe in 1994. And it's out between Mars and Jupiter. Average diameter is about 20 miles, but it's kind of lumpy. You think most of the asteroids are very strange shapes. They're not spherical. They look like, you know, melted potatoes or something. And the only thing that really makes it remarkable, besides the fact that we were able to image it fairly close up because Galileo happened to be passing by the neighborhood at the time, is it has a small new moon orbiting it called Dactyl.
Ah.
Which kind of sounds dinosaurian in itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Next on the list is Vesta.
Yeah.
Which is one of the major asteroids out in the asteroid belt. So the asteroid belt is this big ring of junk, the preplanetary junk in between Mars and Jupiter. And it almost looks like a huge ring of Saturn, but it girdles the whole solar system. So Vesta was first imaged by the Dawn mission, D-A-W-N, back in 2011. And it's a big sucker. It's 326 miles diameter. And even though that's large, but it's not that large as planetoids go. But what makes it kind of remarkable is it's got a mountain on it that's higher than Mount Everest. So when you scale that to the size of the asteroid, that's a really big mountain on a really small asteroid. It kind of looks like something out of The Little Prince, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the second largest after Ceres, which is the next in the list. So Ceres, because of its size and shape, qualifies as the only dwarf planet the size of Neptune. Of course, we all remember that Pluto was demoted to dwarf planet status,
right,
amidst much controversy. The first asteroid discovered, it's the largest in the asteroid belt at 580 miles diameter. It's the only one that is a naturally occurring spherical object of the asteroids, formed by its own gravity because of its mass. So the Dawn probe went in orbit around that in 2015, and that was really interesting because they discovered salty ice brines on the surface,
And they thought, what the heck is that doing out here in an asteroid? Because we always thought, you know, for a long time, the asteroids were just dry rocks.
Right.
They're junk that hasn't, that didn't form into a planet. Turns out it's got kind of a complex structure. There's ice down below, and it's actually one of the first places we saw cryovolcanoes, which are volcanoes that erupt ice. And they discovered organic molecules on the surface. So this is where the solar system starts getting really interesting, because now you're seeing things that you can't really explain and you didn't expect there, like organic, you know, things that are predecessors to life potentially on the surface. And you start asking questions about how did that get there, and what's the next step, and how many steps between that and bacteria and mosquitoes and so forth. So, it was a really interesting place.
Okay.
Next one is...
Yeah, hold on, Rod. Rod, hold on a second, because we got a couple calls here. Here's Lena on WGN. Okay. Go ahead, Lena.
Hey, Rod, I always enjoy it when you're on for these segments. I have a question about the black hole, the miniature black hole that you brought up. I didn't understand that.
So, apparently, and as Nick knows, I'm not an astrophysicist, so I'll do the best I can here, but black holes are scalable as natural phenomenon, at least in theory. And they're so incredibly dense, if you will. They're not a solid object, but I mean, they're this basically this pinprick in space. So if this black hole came down, I mean, it could be the size of, you know, a thumbtack head, or much smaller potentially. But because of all the forces at work there, if that came into contact with a planet, it would be a very bad day. So that's how that theory runs. I don't think that's widely accepted. I think it's more widely accepted it was probably either a big rock or a chunk of ice.
Because that's something we see a lot. Yeah, because it seems like, I mean, the density of a black hole is just like infathomable to most, I think, all of us. So it has to be so minuscule to not have
tiny,
the planet.
Like a pinhead. Yeah, so I think I just brought that up because it's one of the interesting outliers in those theories. But, you know, if you look at the far side of the moon versus the near side of the moon, you can see what a disaster zone the early solar system was, because it's just beat to hell and back. It's just totally cratered, every square inch of it. And as Neil Armstrong observed when he first got up there in 69, if you get down and look at the surface of the moon, no matter how close you get, you keep seeing smaller and smaller craters all the way down to micro pits. So it's just been impacted for billions of years, and we realized just how much junk there was flying around the solar system those early days. And so it's a lot of it's still out there, which is why we got to watch out for asteroids that come whizzing past the Earth, because some of them are dangerous.
Yep. Okay, Lena, thanks for the call. Here's James on WGN. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, I've got a question. Why couldn't the old shuttle be used? Of course, it has to be updated. But you'd have to increase the tank by a third and put a couple more boosters onto it. The reason why you'd have to increase it, that way you'd have fuel, and you could refuel it while it was in space.
So the problem with the shuttle is it was kind of a closed-end design. It was supposed to be cheaper than Apollo. It was supposed to be reusable, fully reusable, and it was neither of those things. It ended up being more expensive than the Saturn V to fly and only partially reusable. But that technology doesn't scale well, and this is something Elon Musk found out with the Falcon Heavy. He thought he was just going to slap together three Falcon rockets and have this big mega booster. Turns out it takes a lot more engineering than that. Finally, the shuttle was kind of operating at the extreme edge of the technology of the era as it was. So I think scaling it up the way you're talking about, while it makes sense on the surface, you start getting into problems of scale when you do that, and things just don't work as well anymore. So it was kind of operating about as well as it could given that design. And just to be fair to NASA, that wasn't their original design intention. That was the result of Nixon's incessant budget cutting in the late 60s, early 70s. Mm. And that's why they had this compromised design.
Okay. All right, James, thanks for the call. All right, Rod, let's get back to a few more of these asteroids.
Okay, which one do you want next?
Let's go to 162173.
Ryugu. So this was an asteroid that was explored by Japan's Hayabusa 2 probe just last year, and not much remarkable about it, except that we've been to it, and it shot a projectile into the surface and watched what happened, and then also picked up a sample, so it's returning to Earth with a sample now, which is going to be interesting to see what these sort of primordial bits of the solar system are like, because this is really like walking into the biggest, it's the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you're walking into the museum of the solar system's early days. Bennu is the target of the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is a NASA ESA mission. It arrived in 2008. It's orbiting now. It's still investigating. It's going to do a sample return in 2023. Bennu has the distinction of being a potentially hazardous object for Earth. It's got a 1 in 2,700 chance of impacting between 2175 and 2199, so we don't care. But it's 1,600 feet wide, so that could be a big, nasty, five-mile-wide crater taking out a better part of a state by the time you account for all the shockwave effects and stuff. Here's my favorite, Didymus and Diddy Moon.
Okay.
So this is, besides the fact that it's cute, so it's a fairly large asteroid with a fairly small moon going around it. What's remarkable about this one is that the target for the DART mission, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test mission, which is going up either next year or the year after that, and they're going to basically slam a spacecraft into Diddy Moon, the smaller of the two, to see if they can deflect it, just to get a handle on if we do see the dangerous asteroid coming our way in the future, you know, what kind of technology intervention can we do to try and keep it from hitting Earth? So the earlier you deflect them, obviously, the wider the vector that they'll miss Earth by. Well, then we have the lyrically named 2019 OD, which is the size of a 747. What made it unique is that it passed Earth inside the diameter of the lunar orbit in 2018, and that's somewhere between 200 and 400 feet in diameter, so that would be a bad afternoon. 99942 Apophis will pass within 19,000 miles of Earth in 2029, so now you're really coming down close, too close for comfort for a lot of people.
Yeah,
that's 1,100 feet across. So again, a very large crater in the order of many miles and would wipe out something between the size of a county and a small state. And then, of course, you've got all that stuff blown up in the atmosphere. So besides the area that it actually causes all its destruction in, it also causes terrible atmospheric effects and crop loss and
Rod,
all that.
Rod, we're out of time.
Yes, sir.
We're out of time.
Okay.
But thank you, Rod Pyle, everybody. And let's go to the news.